Hi everyone, good morning. My name is Janice Hernandez. I'm the Director of Green Communities with Enterprise Community Partners. And interestingly enough, I think my talk is a nice segue in terms of the theme of broadening the net. I think that one of the things that Enterprise is really interested in doing is beginning to take the research and apply it to actual built environments. And our work primarily focuses on affordable housing development and preservation. So just I wanted to just give a quick snapshot on what I'll be talking about today. I'm going to really focus on, from our vantage point, why health matters in housing. Interestingly enough, Enterprise is an organization that has an over 30-year history in supporting affordable housing development. And to the points that were raised in the previous presentation, we're seeing reverse trends on just establishing that secure base. We're still seeing challenges in underserved communities, so we're realizing that we need to take a much more holistic and comprehensive approach. And some of the research that we've been involved in, along with Rebecca Schaap at the National Center for Healthy Housing. So this is just a quick snapshot about Enterprise. Enterprise is an organization that provides both technical and financial assistance to the direct development and preservation of affordable housing through grants, equity, as well as lending capital. And through that work, we've invested $16 billion to create and preserve over 300,000 affordable units throughout the country. So we're really proud of those numbers because it represents us providing a secure base for many families across the country. And interestingly enough, in 2004, Enterprise launched our Green Communities Initiative, and Rebecca actually just reminded me, and I actually was reminded that we were both here just about a month ago at the U.S. Green Building Council talking about this very topic. So I like to say now that although I live in the community development space, I want to be a public health professional when I grow up. So with that said, in 2004, we launched Green Communities when we started to realize that, as I mentioned before, we were seeing affordable housing being priced out of core city centers. So we started to realize that that families of affordable housing were being pushed out of walkable neighborhoods, areas where they can gain access to quality schools as well as quality employment. And interestingly enough, we started to move into sustainability from a smart growth perspective and realized very quickly that we wanted to also consider energy efficiency along with location efficiency and health. And as I mentioned, Rebecca reminded me that in 2004 we thought that we would just establish a program for 5 years, and in 5 years we'd change the world and everyone would be building green affordable housing, and we realized that we're just scratching the surface. But with that said, we established a core framework for defining what it means to be green in the context of affordable housing, because in our world, just like in the public health arena, constrained resources is very much our reality in terms of implementation. So we took tenants from both the National Center for Healthy Housing, Healthy Homes principles work that the U.S. Green Building Council has done to really knit together a holistic approach to greening affordable housing. And I like to just tout these accomplishments over the 10 years because Enterprise just celebrated our 10-year anniversary of Green Communities in September of this year. And within that time, we were able to invest nearly $3 billion in the preservation and development of green affordable housing. And that translates into supporting 40,000 affordable homes throughout the country. And we also worked to provide technical assistance to build the capacity of our community development partners to really understand how best to apply these particular strategies, and we're able to help support the greening of 40,000 affordable homes throughout the country. And interestingly enough, in our latest iteration of Enterprise's large-scale strategic plan that was just released this year as well, we started to realize that, again, as I mentioned earlier, housing affordability continues to be an issue across this country. There is definitely a housing crisis, and as a result, what tends to happen is that families have to make some really, just unfortunate trade-offs in terms of paying for housing versus paying for other amenities such as healthcare, transportation, and food. So as a result of that, we're really focusing in on ensuring that the quality, again, provides that secure base for those families. And many of you, I include these slides, but these are sort of known stats at this point and probably could be updated for many researchers in this room in terms of the impacts of substandard housing on children in particular. So I wanted to just take a minute to just talk a little bit about our Green Communities criteria, because it sort of touches upon all of the elements sort of discussed throughout some of the other panel presentations, mainly focusing on how, again, the built environment can drive better health outcomes. And we really looked at greening affordable housing and instilling sustainability practices as a preventative health strategy. So this particular slide really just touches upon all of the specific elements of the Green Communities criteria that are in fact mandatory, starting with location efficiency. We have requirements around walkability to get to the point around just sort of the built environments, promotion of active physical activity. We also include a healthy living environment section, which is quite frankly the largest section in the criteria and one of the ones that we got the most pushback from our development community. Many folks saw the ROI of energy efficiency and water conservation, but it was harder to prove out from their standpoint, from an operation standpoint, the healthier building measures, which if they're not required by code, developers will not do them because they're not necessary because of, again, the cost containment concerns. So this is just a quick snapshot. I love this slide. It actually, I think, builds off of a study that was done that I'll talk about in a minute in Seattle that many of you all know that identify ways in which we can really improve the indoor environment to, again, protect health. And really quickly, I just wanted to, I've been sort of shopping this around. I also presented this at the Green Build Conference. This is sort of how we're beginning to really frame the health, the healthy housing definition. There are seven principles, but ultimately we really want to ensure that we're creating a comfortable, clean, and chemical as well as critter-free environment for families. And ultimately, the fourth piece is the newer area that Enterprise is actually working on a new iteration of the Green Communities criteria that is looking to enhance health beyond just the indoor environment. And interestingly enough, we are looking at the connections around the community. As I mentioned, we started from a smart growth perspective. We're sort of going back to our roots, and I definitely see a lot of learnings from the sustainability movement that could be applied to the early days of this new renewed health movement. But ultimately, really thinking about those connections to open space, those connections to nutritional food options, as well as preventative health care offerings versus urgent care visits. So those are new elements that we're really excited about weaving into. We've actually engaged a group by the name of the Health Impact Project, as well as staff from U.S. Green Building Council, in support of thinking about how best to define this and apply it more broadly beyond our criteria. And this is just a quick snapshot of some of the studies that we thought would just make the case for us. And interestingly enough, this study was done about 5 years ago now. Jim Krieger, who's with the King County Health Department out of Washington State, conducted this really, from our vantage point in the affordable housing industry, a really groundbreaking study that has been touted to this day, that evaluated the health effects of asthmatic children moving into what he referred to as breathe easy homes, these homes that really applied enhanced indoor environmental and air quality strategies to, again, improve the built environment, and as a result of about 35 households being studied, they saw dramatic improvements in reducing urgent care visits, as well as increasing symptom-free days. So realizing that, again, that direct connection. And as a houser, not a researcher, I thought this was it, right? This should prove to developers and financiers and policymakers that every house that we build should have all of these strategies, right? No. So with that said, we started to work with other researchers across many affordable housing projects to begin to build that evidence base. So Breathe Easy Homes was one of the first. We also worked with the National Center for Healthy Housing very early on in a study of a project in Worthington, Minnesota known as Viking Terrace. And again, we're able to cull together a nice sort of small literature base of all of these particular studies. This is one project out of the South Bronx where I grew up, that evaluated a project that was actually one of the first LEED for Homes platinum projects that was certified under their at that time a pilot program. And interestingly enough, they found that they were able to retain 18 households. This was a 60-unit property, and they were able to retain 18 households throughout the study. But ultimately, one of the interesting things that I actually appreciate about this particular study is it included one-on-one asthma education of the residents that participated in the study. And what they found was that one-on-one education, those families were able to retain that information when they went back a year later. So there's this opportunity to provide that one-on-one education that will enable them to, you know, take better care and maintenance of their homes to, again, provide a cleaner environment for their families. And this is another study that we also, in partnership with the National Center for Healthy Housing, were involved in that I like the title of it. It's called Watts to Well-Being, and it was a HUD-funded study that evaluated the impact of weatherization and energy conservation improvements on multifamily properties in both New York, Chicago, and Boston. And it really evaluated resident comfort, and it found throughout, I think there were over 230 households that were retained in this particular study, that found that residents did sort of improve their health based on self-reported data. Again, this was, I think, one of the other challenges, and I'll talk a little bit about it as I veer into sort of the new wave of research that we're involved in, that through some of this research, we always get the gaps and the slings and arrows that go through, that get poked into them because of the methodology. And one of the concerns about some of these studies that have previously been done is that it's been based on self-reported data and not necessarily including objective health parameters. So as a result of that, Enterprise, in partnership with the National Center for Healthy Housing, as well as the Mount Sinai School of Medicine and the University of California in Northern California and the University of Illinois in Chicago, established a robust study methodology to do what we're hoping will be a definitive study to prove out the benefits of greening affordable housing, particularly as it relates to families with asthmatic children. So we spent a lot of time to really ensure that we were collecting the right level of information, not only based on self-reported information, but also a series of objective health parameters. Families will be going through a series of lung function tests. We are also doing some tests on based on allergens, so that we can begin to connect those exposures based on if they're allergic to pests. Then there's integrative pest management strategies in place, whether or not that's actually having an impact on their allergies. So based on that, it's a very long study, and we were able to secure generous support from both the JPB Foundation, the Kresge Foundation, and Wells Fargo, and we raised several million dollars to begin to roll out this study, this multi-site study in both New York, Northern California, and Chicago. So as I mentioned, these are our study partners. It takes a village, as they say, but it's incredible to have this level of expertise on board, because again, Enterprise, we're a housing organization. We're doing this because we want to be able to make the case to the financial institutions, to the policymakers, to our developers, that incorporating these strategies makes sense. And this is just a quick snapshot of all of the advisory committee members that we've brought on to help sort of serve as our brain trust as well. And this is just a quick summary of our just study hypotheses here. Again, we're really targeting through this study housing renovation. So we want to be able to capture that baseline information of families that are about to go through a renovation that will meet either our green communities criteria or an equivalent standard across the country. This is a 7-year study, so this is a very long-term study because, again, because of the way affordable housing is developed and financed, the volume in which we would need to really ensure that we collect and retain a valid sample set will take several years as part of the enrollment process, which is the longest process you'll see there in the study design. And as I mentioned, we're looking to cast a wide net in terms of retaining several hundred children as part of the study across all three sites. And interestingly enough, we're actually we're days away from starting enrollment in New York City, and at this point in time, we're working with the City of New York and Conus Island here, but for the, one of the biggest concerns that the city has at this point is liability. They're concerned that the results that the residents are set to receive can be used in a lawsuit in the future. Many, you know, as many of you mentioned, lead continues to be an issue. New York City has had a very storied history with lead. Lead still very much is present in many multifamily buildings today in New York City. And as a result, the city has sustained several lawsuits and liability as a result. So one of the concerns that they have is, okay, we know that some of the issues that we're seeing through this study will be corrected once the renovation is in place. However, there's still some concerns there that we're working through. So interestingly enough, you know, it's always, the ideal scenario is always, you know, always sort of, you know, knocked down when the implementation comes into play and all of these other real life factors kind of, you know, take precedent. But ultimately, the city's still very much interested in participating. They want to. They just want to figure out how they can protect themselves against lawsuits. As we all do, right, in life? Okay, great. So really quickly, and if anyone wants more detail, I'm happy to talk after. This is just sort of this is another snapshot of the specific elements that will be incorporated into the methodology in terms of the data collection processes and protocols. We will include environmental sampling, and this is actually the issue. This is the sticking point with the city. They're fine with everything else except the reporting that residents get back for environmental sampling, which is interesting because it only happens in 15% of the households. But ultimately, this is where we actually test the air quality within the environment for a four-day period. As I mentioned, the medical testing, there are three tests, two which will really test lung function, the other, the blood specimen around allergen testing. And interestingly enough, I think we were talking about ROI, and one of the components of this study, and we did actually engage a health economist to serve as a study partner in this, is that we're also collecting information about healthcare utilization to begin to demonstrate the potential reductions in healthcare costs as a result of the families moving into a much more greener environment. So hopefully, check in with us in 6 years. Hopefully, we've seen some results. And finally, this is just a really quick flowchart of of our process. One of the other elements of this study that, again, is sort of a reaction to the criticisms that housing studies have received in the past is we're also including a control group in this particular study. We're looking at targeting about and retaining about 200 households across all three cities to serve as our control, where no interventions will happen in those households during the study period. Ideally, we're looking to target households that will be slated for a renovation within the next 2 to 3 years. But at that particular study period, we want to be able to demonstrate that, again, that a control exists and we can be able to see without the intervention of the renovation whether or not that control can be compared to the study intervention group. So I just wanted to just close by saying that I think one of the key pieces that I hope is a theme throughout this conference and many others is that there's so much potential to engage the community development community in the public health goals that are in play right now. I think many of the interesting conversations that we've been a part of now realize that the built environment plays such a major role, and there needs to be more that to be done with regards to how we as community developers really work to in partnership with public health officials to ensure that we are enhancing the quality of the homes that we're building as well as the community facilities. So with that, I'll turn it over to Rebecca.
We'll take clarifying questions for Janice, and then we'll open up to a broader conversation.
Versus brand new construction.
launched our Green Communities initiative, it was mainly we invested, the enterprise also serves as an intermediary in terms of investing in affordable housing, and the first 5 years focused primarily on new construction. And interestingly enough, in 2008, when the housing crisis hit, there was a dramatic shift to the preservation of existing housing, because we realized, working with our community development organizations, many of them, as a result of the drying up of resources to support new construction, were almost under threat of losing their existing portfolios. So we shifted gears and focused on supporting the preservation and also enhancement of the quality of their existing portfolios. So with that said, over the course of the 10 years of our initiative, it's been an even split, because of the work that we do with our community development organizations and preserving affordable housing. And I will say that in areas like New York, preservation is going to be a key area of focus because of not only preservation of quality, but preservation of affordability. Many of the developments that have received financing that basically safeguards the affordability are running out of that compliance period, and the challenge there is that then they convert to either market rate or they get sold. So that's an area that we're really focused on as well. So
thank you. That's sort of why I was asking.
Yes, and then you.
So you had these previous studies in hand that you thought were going to be home runs, and then they didn't work out for you quite like you had. And then with this new study that sounds really interesting, you're addressing a lot of those, perhaps the critiques for those studies. But what I'm really interested in is what kind of support you're seeking or what your plans are to message this new study differently to the people that you really want to touch, so that maybe from the get-go you can have a different story you're telling, rather than this is just the same study that they're giving us that we ignored all the other ones.
That's a great question. Interestingly enough, we've actually engaged a graphic design firm in New York, because I agree with you. We end up, you know, having these beautiful research studies or papers that we're excited if maybe 10 people read them, right? So one of the things that they've done for us, and I'm happy to share with you some of the materials that they've pulled together, because they've done a great job of what I like to say, de-wonkifying our language, so making it a little bit more accessible to our development community. Because as I mentioned, our development community, they care about, you know, improving the community, preserving and protecting affordable housing, but they're not researchers. So when we talk about, you know, when we talk about spirometry or when we talk about, you know, all these, they're not going to get that. So to your point, we're really trying to figure out what are the right mechanisms to translate that message to make it meaningful to developers, policymakers, and financial institutions. So to your point, one of the key things, once we start to launch this study, again, starting with New York City, hopefully in the next month or so, we want to be able to have, and this is where the younger people in my office sort of know better about sort of social, like more social media engagement and actually YouTube videos about some of the testing that's happening on site. So they're trying to adopt different ways of at least keeping the story going, because the biggest concern I had is this is a 7-year study. You're gonna go into a black box in 7 years and come out like, remember us? We said we were gonna do this. So to your point, we definitely are gonna build that in, and I'm happy to take your card to make sure you're part of that group that we intend to reach out to.
Thanks, Denise. And did you have a question?
Yeah. I'm Winnie Hamilton, I'm Gretchen Barlow, Alfredo College of Medicine, Houston. And we have a 1-year intervention that's home based. And we're running into a number of things. So one is that a lot of things like spirometry is kind of finding the quality of life, something that you're permitting as the quality of life, some of those sort of happiness scores actually work better as far as, you know, because they're much more comprehensive. Spirometry is just too one time, it varies too much with local conditions. Same thing with blood levels. Another thing that we're finding is that a lot of our homes and working in the city and throughout three, four questions, I guess, and Harris County, we have clean homes as far as paint. We have homes that are away from freeways and stuff like that. What we're finding, and maybe it's because Houston's so industrial, but we're having massive issues with take home. So industry is so massively using lead in everything. So PVC pipe, a pipe fitter, cutting pipe, you get lead. All plastic pretty much has lead in it. The Afghan community uses eyeliner to protect their children against evil too. We have to find something. And so what we're doing right now is when our kids come into our pediatric clinic, we're actually using our Lexcure analyzer to test the adults. We can't get them in, because that's very often they'll have levels of around 100. And so their kids all have levels around 30. And so without addressing them, and their homes are clean. The other thing, I'm going to use really quickly. So another thing is that our families, and our house is obviously pretty bad, and we have these communities that are all Latino, 42% of our population is Latino, and they're in substandard housing, there's no doubt about that. They're paying $300 a month for a little bungalow, which all they can afford, and their whole safety net is in that community. So their sisters and mothers and brothers and cousins, and they're all working together. We cannot relocate them without they're losing everything. And so moving them, we're doing the same as a homeless community. We're having to move whole bridge populations into affordable housing together. Otherwise, they won't stay because they lose everything that's important to them. And the very last thing is livable wage. I think these people, our clients are working as hard as they can. Usually they're often working two jobs. They cannot, and they're doing things like cleaning these rooms that we cannot exist without. They're working hard, and they should be paid a lot more. I think that a little wage issue is the biggest issue in trying to help people. We just can't give them things without appreciating the hard work that they do financially.
Thanks. Thank you for all those really insightful comments. Thank you very much. Peter.
Yeah, I'm Peter Ashley with Hud's Office of Help Young. I got in a little late, but the first speaker, I heard you say that we need to get away from kind of the narrow focus on cost benefit and on investment. But we're in the same place as our EPA colleague, where we have Congress saying, you've got your Help Young program. They're okay with that because we've got a lot of good studies showing a return on investment for them. Very skeptical about healthy homes, and it seems like it should be pretty obvious when you split it into separate components, like putting in small detectors, et cetera. But what's our alternative if they're demanding, sometimes you reduce it to someone, a staffer on the probation school who wants this information, our OMB. So what's our alternative? We shouldn't do a return on investment when you're focused on cost effectiveness. And then a follow-up to the panel. We look at asthma a lot because we can see that in the short term, and it's good because that might get us to a way to improve housing and get some other payers to help pay for health insurance. But it seems like what we really need is a study with a pretty good sized population that includes other endpoints, injury prevention, psychological endpoints, especially with greening of housing, improved housing. And that's just a question to throw out. How do we get there? Rebecca, you might have some thoughts on that. Cost, of course, is pretty expensive, but we really should be looking at those multiple endpoints, especially trying to get return on investment so we can really see the broad benefits.
I'd love to ask Peter, I think Laura, maybe you want to respond to the first part of the question, maybe others have feedback too, but Peter, the National Children's Study, I don't know if maybe if you have any information or if anyone in this room has any information about where we stand on that, because that study was going to be longitudinal, there was lots of environmental health measures in it, there were housing measures, I think, at some point, and that has been one of our biggest challenges is that we have very few data sets that are at the child level that combine environmental health and housing and kids, and so I don't know. I haven't been following it, so.
So the Children's Environmental Health Network has been one of the strongest champions for that study, and I will say we are at a very unfortunate place right now where we're not even sure how much longer we'll be supporting that publicly, just because it has changed so much from its original intent. There's been a lot of combinations of why and, a lot of political issues, change of director and change of staff and all kinds of things. At the end of the day, talking about cost-benefit, at one point, when there was so much fraction, there were questions about the methodology and how data was being collected. At one point, originally, they were going door-to-door. That's a very expensive way to collect samples. So then they changed the methodology, and then they were collecting samples through the pediatric offices and healthcare practitioner offices. That's great, but it was almost a little too late for those in the congressional seats. At that point, many offices had changed. We were just waiting for an opportunity to continue to poke holes at this study. So there's a lot of concern about the cost to date and then the projected cost. But the reality is, when you combine what this study, hopefully it still will continue to move forward. Because I think, although it's not still what we intended it to be, it's been watered down a bit as pertaining to the environmental health exposures that it was originally supposed to connect the dots on. But I still do believe, personally, that it still will be a benefit if we can continue to protect what we have. I know that the National Institute for Environmental Health Sciences, Linda Birnbaum, the director, is personally now involved. That's how upset she is. I know that the EPA is extremely, you know, upset that we're at a place where it's being held and we're not getting the good work done. So I think that right now what I would suggest is that, and I know the National Academy of Sciences has been involved. I mean, it's been a lot of energy to just decide, do we just give up our hands right now and stop? Data was being collected. Vanguard centers were collecting data. I'm curious as to where that data is. You know, there's a lot of unknowns, but I would say that as of right now, a lot of us are still working with our federal partners to hopefully continue to salvage what we can, because it's already been started. The reality is, if we lose this opportunity now, I think that this, unfortunately, will be a very negative place for us collectively. And I don't think us, Peter, will be in the luxurious position for a long time of even beginning to think about another longitudinal study unless we have our own private funding. That's as sad as that would be. Because the reality is, the funding for this study still doesn't even come into close comparison to Gene and Environment and some other longitudinal studies. And even there's a Japanese version of our children's study that's doing great things. So there's certainly lessons learned across, and I believe we were part of the stimulus for some of the overseas studies. So there's a lot of interesting international implications as well as, of course, domestic. So I wish I had a better outcome, but I know it's not dead yet,
right.
But it's in a very limbo, very vulnerable situation, and certainly to the extent that we can gather more information, we'll continue to share with our partners out there what we know and what the guidance may be, but we as an organization are not willing to give up on it yet, but unfortunately it's becoming harder and harder to support.
And thanks for that kind of sobering update. Laura, any response or reaction to Peter's question about this issue of, you know, do you do narrow kind of niche cost-benefit analysis or, you know, more holistic, and, and what are some of the challenges there?
So I think that I don't think we throw out return on investment or cost benefit. I think we have to be very thoughtful and have those economists working with us to make sure we're doing it right. Because I think a poorly done study is actually more damaging than none at all. But that we also recognize and continue to support that value of environmental health goes beyond return on investment. And although, unfortunately, in our government, that's what it boils down to, I think the satisfaction, you know, quality of life indicators, that qualitative data is just as important. But we tend, and I can speak from a professor, we tend to sort of shy away from that stuff because it's not as hard. But I think, you know, we need to collectively say there's two sides to every story. And, you know, would you want to live in the green space or do you want to live in the dirty, polluted space? I mean, you know, so I think that we're at a turning point where, you know, we've been reduced so much environmental health services at the local and state level in public health departments that we really need to sort of kind of center ourselves, figure out what it is that we do really well, and tell those stories both qualitatively and quantitatively, and not be embarrassed to talk about the qualitative stuff, the satisfaction of where you live, those kinds of things.
I think on the congressional piece and this idea, there's a theme here about combining the story with the data and how powerful that is. And I think that actually works on the Hill very well, too, especially if the story comes from someone's backyard, you know, district, or the person's there to tell their own story. Appropriations people are unique in the sense that they are so metrics driven. And so that is a challenge. But, you know, I always think those same appropriation staff people work for a boss who has personal office staff who goes to a district that talks to real people, and so to the extent that we can influence that, I think we'll be more successful. I had a question for Janice, actually, and I should know the answer to this, but it's something that I've been thinking about for a long time, which is what level of information does the housing finance world or sector really need as it comes to, when it comes down to health? Like, what do they really need? What level of rigor? And I guess the related question of who is it that we're trying to influence in the community development world? Is it the people that are making the loans and doing the low-income housing tax credits? Like, who, just for the, I think the edification of the public health world here, who are the players in community development and how do we persuade them?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think, you know, it always starts with the public housing, I mean the Housing Finance Agency, because they sort of set a certain cap in terms of the development, and I'm going to get a little wonky right now, but the per unit cost of a particular development based on its location and whether or not it's a renovation or a new construction. So what typically happens is that they receive an allocation of federal tax credits that flow down, and they sort of establish a competitive application process based on, again, that per unit cost figure. Like, you have to do all of these things, and then you've got to meet this budget. So what tends to happen is, you not only are sustainability measures sort of built into that competitive application process, but also sort of any sort of regional or economic development sort of opportunities to ensure that there's sort of potentials for job or wealth generation for those particular families as well as the surrounding community members. So you've got this laundry list of all of the things that a developer has to oblige by in order to meet, in order to seek out these resources. So typically where we sort of focus our energy is on that Housing Finance Agency to ensure that they have a clear sense of that they're getting sort of the biggest bang for their sort of public dollars. And with that said, it was interesting because during the current iteration of the Green Community Criteria Update process, we reached out to several staff across Housing Finance Agencies that we work with across various states. And interestingly enough, they looked at the current version of the latest version of the 2015 draft, and we were sort of nervous because we added some new things that they were, you know, we thought that they would balk against. And interestingly enough, there were certain elements about sort of access to fresh and local food that they wanted us to build upon. They were like, no, these are things that we want you to actually provide a little bit more sort of rigor around. We really want to ensure that if we're investing in these housing units, that they are connected to those levels of amenity. So it's now that demand where before we were sort of pushing them, now mm-hmm. they're pushing us, which I think is an interesting and exciting trend, truth be told, over the past 10 years. That's one of the sort of stakeholders because they mandate how those dollars flow. The other are the financial institutions that then invest in those tax credits. So we want to be able to show to them that yes, they'll be paying a little bit more for a particular housing unit, but they potentially will see, you know, these ancillary benefits mm-hmm. beyond just the affordable housing being available. And then the third sort of stakeholder group, if you will, are our community development organizations. Many mm-hmm. of them have been in this field for over 30 years. They know how to build housing well, and they know how to build housing within a budget, right? That's how they've been sort of conditioned over the past several decades. So asking them to sort of change course slightly can be challenging, which is why we build the resource base to be able to demonstrate by pointing out examples that this can in fact be achieved.
So when you get home, talk to your housing finance agencies, community development organizations, and the financiers of football thing. I actually think APHA should convene some sort of webinar or some discussion where Enterprise does a 101 on housing and community development for the public health world. Could be really helpful. All right. Well, can you guys join me in thanking our terrific panelists? Thank you guys very much.